Hello and welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Kind of a fun way to start Garden Talk on a Friday, I think, or a Saturday. It's wonderful to talk gardening, and it's wonderful to have my guest today, Liz Freemuth. Liz, you know what? I heard someone passed this along, a poet, Saadi Shirazi, a Persian poet. He was born about 1210 in Iran. He said, "A garden is a delight to the eye and a solace for the soul."
Absolutely.
Isn't that wonderful?
That is a beautiful way to put it.
Oh, it's a wonderful way to put it. Liz, by the way, provides concierge horticultural services around the country. She was telling me about where she's been, and it's all over the place. She has a business. It's called The Garden Hoe, and she comes by every so often. It's always a lot of fun to have her with us, and we can talk about all kinds of things. Gardening is a solace for the soul. I'm sure we can talk about that, but we'll also talk about weird vegetables and fun flowering shrubs, and certainly take your gardening questions, and maybe you have an unusual plant that you like. I hope you'll tell us about it. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you have a garden photo, maybe it's flowers, maybe it's gardens, whatever, I hope you'll post it up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly you can ask your question there as well. And you're a busy gal.
I have been kind of busy. Yeah, I like that. I like it a lot. Been traveling around a little bit. This last trip, it's been a little hard to get used to the 40-degree temps, which feel balmy here. But it's been 70. I was out in San Diego, and it was 75 and gorgeous. The sun was shining. Mm. And, you know, I got lots of wonderful ideas looked at. Tons of tropical fruit gardens, and it was just absolutely wonderful, and it was a balm for the soul. It was definitely well-needed balm. But, you know, I love coming home. I love watching stuff start to pop, and right now down in the southern part of the state, we've got apricots blooming, and so you know that that's the start, and there's just nothing like it. Although I will say that the citrus fields in California were just blossoming, so the smell was heavenly. If people have not had a chance to smell what a citrus in blossom does to you, find a greenhouse that grows them and go and sniff away, because it is just perfume. It makes you feel like spring is here. It's wonderful.
Well, we've got, I mentioned that we'd talk about some unusual plants. Mm-hmm. We can talk flowers. We can talk vegetables. Yeah. What do you want to start with?
Well, let's start with some veggies, because right now we're looking at not much for frost in the ground at all, if you have any. You know, when you get to the northern part of the state, they're still dealing with it. But in the southern half, we really don't have, and I know way in the south, we have nothing for frost in the ground. And so we really are kind of getting close to where you need to think about getting things in. Grandma would be disappointed in me if my potatoes were not in by Easter, so I need to get cracking on that and get those done. So potatoes, definitely. And I don't know about you, Larry, what you like to plant for potatoes, but I'm loving the purple fingerlings. They are fantastic.
They are wonderful, aren't they?
They are, and to me, it's a very filling potato. I don't know that it has any more fiber or anything else in it, but it just, you have a couple purples on the plate and you're good to go. You know, it doesn't have to be a half-pound mound of mashed potatoes. Just give me a couple purples and I'm good. And they're ready so soon that you can put those in, and you're going to have some nice early summer potatoes.
That's a great idea. What about, you were telling me about a radish that you like.
Oh, I love rat tail radish.
Rat tail radish.
And that's one to really give a try. It is if you can find the seed, and I know I found it at a few garden centers around Madison, so you should be able to find it. If not, look it up. I'm pretty sure it's Baker Seeds online that you can find a lot of those things. But it doesn't develop the edible root, the ball that you're going after, you know, the normal radish is a ball or an elongated cylinder of some kind. This actually is edible at the top of the leaves, and they're rather needleish in appearance, and it tastes just like a radish, and it's small, and it's pungent, and it's got a peppery flavor, and it's well worth putting in. It's a good conversation piece.
Well, for sure. And you could just, you use the, cut the leaves up maybe and use them in salad? Or
you know, like with any of that, anything. The leaves are so, so usable. But it's really right at the tip, and it'll be a little bit on the bulby side, but it doesn't look like a full blown radish. And it's not something you look at and you think, seriously, that's what I'm supposed to eat? And it's like, yes, yeah, definitely. Eat that, eat that. I don't know that people could put in enough arugula to make us all happy. Arugula is not weird, but you know, people don't think that they can grow that in their own yards. And it actually makes a beautiful border plant. And you can cut. So, you know, if you've got a spot where you want a little bit of green early in the season, you just sprinkle those seeds in, cut to your heart's content. And when you're done, they actually have a little white flower that comes up off of them once they're past the point of using the leaves. So that's an unusual one that you can use anywhere, absolutely anywhere.
Sunny location for them?
Sunny, but you know, almost any of the greens, arugula, lettuces, chards, will take a bit of shade, so it doesn't have to be 8 full hours. You get, I would say, the pepperiest flavor when you've got full sun on those, but then you also have to watch for bolting fairly quickly.
In terms of flowers, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I would love to have flowers that smell great.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them look great, but then they don't smell great.
Exactly. Before we move to flowers, I do want to mention edamame, too.
Oh, right.
I want to mention an edamame, and I'm not going to pronounce it right because I don't speak Japanese, but it's A-O-Y-U. And it was the most phenomenal edamame we have planted, and it was... it was no work at all, period. It tasted great right out of the garden, right out of the pod. But then you just boiled it slightly, you know, or microwaved it slightly and add a little bit of salt, and it was the best you have ever eaten. It is absolutely fantastic. So I would give that one a big thumbs up. On to flowers. Fragrant flowers. Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate that in the breeding cycle, we often will focus on one thing rather than another. So for the longest time, nobody was really focused on scent. And so they were breeding for more height, color, texture, doubles, and often we lose the fragrance in that. Now we're going back to healing gardens, meditative gardens, things like that, where all of the senses are engaged. So we're seeing a little bit of a reversion to let's get back to scent in the breeding. Heliotrope, excuse me, had a moment there. Heliotrope was really a very scented flower way back in Victorian times. They bred for darker color, and the scent sort of disappeared. So a lot of the lighter colored older varieties may have a little bit more scent, but some of the newer ones that they've been breeding, they're breeding scent back in. So I would look, if you're looking for a really nice dark purple, there are a handful of heliotropes out there that are nicely scented. It's kind of a baby powder floral, but not heavy scent, which is really nice. Stock also, you know, you can now get some scented stock flowers. Also freesia. Don't overlook the bulbs that are in the garden center right now. Just because it's an annual doesn't mean it's not worth your while. So take a look at those. They're wonderful.
We like to, or I like to sit out, frankly, and the neighbors come over too, on the front porch in the evening in the summertime and have a beer or a cocktail or something. And so I like something that smells great late in the day. And there's a tobacco.
Nicotiana. Yeah.
Nicotinia,
depending on how you like to pronounce it. But yes, flowering tobacco.
Flowering tobacco is one. Are there some others that...
There are. I personally, my very favorite cocktail shrub is a calycanthus.
Calycanthus.
It's Calycanthus, floridus. And you want to pick a known scented cultivar, because otherwise, if you go with just a species, the flowers are pretty, but it can kind of smell, unfortunately, a little bit like cat pee-pee. And that's not really what you're going for in a scented shrub most of the time. But a lot of them are bred for fragrance, and you'll get some really nice big flowers that don't smell until about 4 o'clock. So for me, that's an excellent cocktail shrub. Yeah. And it blooms May, June, and then will bloom again in July or so very lightly. And the beautiful part about that shrub is that the deer are not particularly fond of it. And it blooms along the stem. So even if they might nibble the end bud off because they don't know what it is, you will still have flowers along the stem. But it smells like a bowl of fruit. And
oh, boy.
And I was in Georgia, it's probably about 5-6 years ago now, in the garden of a gentleman who has since passed away but was a fabric designer at the university. And he had the most glorious garden, absolutely glorious. You could sit on the deck and you could just smell things wafting up at you. And I kept smelling this, like, strawberries and bananas. And I was walking around and looking and couldn't find them. His wife pointed out to me that these huge, massive shrubs are about 15 feet tall with these flowers dripping out of them were calycanthus, and they were smelling wonderful. Well, up here, our calycanthus gets about chest high, and that's it. So I was looking in the wrong spot, but it has got the most wonderful scent, absolutely wonderful. Jasmine, you cannot beat a jasmine for scent, and granted, they're not hardy here, but you put one in a pot and let it trail up the posts of the porch, and you are just in seventh heaven. Absolutely fantastic. Wisteria also is scented and very, very nice. Lots of things that, as far as a tree, Cainanthus, a white fringe tree, that opens in May, and that scent, that smells a little bit like honey. Trees. A wonderful tree for late summer is Heptacodium or Seven Sunflower. That one, again, smells like honey, and it comes out in July or August. So lots out there. Absolutely lots and lots.
Liz Freemuth, our guest today. Great to have her along. She is the owner of her business, The Garden Hole. Great to have her with us. And callers online, but there's still a line open for you at 1-800-642-1234. Let's take a call. Joan and Marshall, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling about Japanese beetles.
Okay.
I'm trying to help bees by planting flowers, but the flowers draw so many Japanese beetles to my yard, I'm wondering what I can do.
Not a whole lot. How long have you been having a problem with Japanese beetles?
4 or 5 years, I would say.
Oh, fortunately. I'm going to say fortunately, because Chris Williamson, eons ago, he's an entomologist up here on campus. He had done research on Japanese beetles early on in his career, and he said once you get to about 5 to 7 years, they start to drop off. The populations will drop off, and then they will level out to a certain extent. So you're still in that increasing population phase right now. The unfortunate thing about Japanese beetles is they're good flyers, and so you can control for them in your own yard. But if everybody within about a 4 mile radius doesn't do the same thing, you're still going to have Japanese beetles. So it's a problem that we have, and we hope the populations drop. Treat where you can, but a lot of people don't want to go out and spray. Are you one of those that wants to keep no spray?
Right. Well, I want to save the bees. That's my primary goal. All of my secondary goal is to get rid of the beetles.
Exactly. Yeah. And so really you've got competing forces there. And I would say don't use traps. Number one, don't use the hormone traps. Please give them to your neighbors. If you don't like your neighbors, give them to them, because they draw beetles in and you don't need any more in your yard than you already have. Japanese beetles will follow the sun around. So if you can provide flowers in shade, you will see less of destruction from the beetles, because they do like the sun. You get a little, but it's not going to be as much. So the bees like the sun. I have not found Japanese beetles to be so bad that you couldn't get something to grow. So my theory on it is just plant away. You're going to lose some, but don't worry about it. Your bees are going to be happy.
And just to support what you were saying, I have grapes growing along one border of the property, and had terrible time with Japanese beetles a few years back, but now last year we had almost no problems at all.
So yeah, and you may see an increase again, because they'll go cyclical where you get a lot, then you get a little, but it never seems to be as bad as that first horrible influx of the critters. So if you can get past this and not get disappointed and discouraged, just keep planting, keep putting things out there. They love things in the rose family. So take a look at where your plant is from, what family it's from. And if you can kind of stay away from things in the rose family, then you may have a little bit better luck.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Joan.
All right.
Good luck.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Liz Freemuth, our guest today on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Lexi Brode, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Next week on Garden Talk, Ben Fuda from the Allen Centennial Gardens will be along to answer your gardening questions. I hope you join us for that. Right now, Liz Freemuth, who provides concierge horticultural services all across the country through her business, The Garden Hoe. She's a Wisconsin gal, though. She's here, and she knows a lot. It's always fun talking with her. Join in, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And I'm going to check the page here and see if we've got some photos. We've got a photo of a limey-like tree, a lime mm-hmm. tree with some limes on it, and that's always fun to see. What about you? Send something in. Let's go to Susie in Boulder Junction next. Susie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is, are there any reputable catalog companies that I can order some flowers and shrubs from? I tried yesterday and found that their website had a whole lot of very bad reviews. Hmm. And it said that this company went under 8 different names, and people told their terrible stories of plants arriving dead and them not being able to get their money back.
Oh, that's terrible. Absolutely terrible. The ones that I use in-state here, Jung's is fantastic. Yep. Depending on what you want, what you're looking for, they're great on fruit. Absolutely yeah. fantastic on fruit. We have quite a few that are in the state. For perennials and shrubs, the owner of a bunch of different companies at Song Sparrow Farm, and he's got some wholesale places. Lovely gentleman named Roy Clem, and they are extremely reputable. And they're not going to be on that low price range, but you're going to get very good plants delivered in absolutely healthy condition, and they have great customer service. The women that work in the office are absolutely fantastic. And Roy does a beautiful job of being out there on the cutting edge of what's coming out new in plants. He and his family are in like fourth or fifth generation peonies breeding and daylilies, and all he's known the world over for his plant work. And he's got his farm is right outside of Janesville.
Oh.
And so that's a fantastic place. And you can go on their website and take a look, and wonderful clematis, peonies, daylilies, woodies, you name it, they have it. I know that they are an extremely reputable company. I tend to go in person, so I'm not the best on everything that's out there
yeah.
As far as mail order. I, like you, go after the reviews. So if you've got good reviews, then that goes a long way.
Yeah.
And what was that again, Roy Clem?
Roy Clem. The company, the online retail catalog is Song Sparrow Farm and Nursery.
Mm-hmm. Song Sparrow.
Song okay. Sparrow Farm and Nursery. And lovely, lovely man. Absolutely lovely. Very knowledgeable.
And Jung's does a good job.
Jung's well. Does a beautiful job. They carry some of the most wonderful and unusual fruit trees that you are ever going to find. And they do a beautiful job growing. And I'm not sure if you can still get bare root from them, but getting bare root trees and shrubs is really easy from them. And I've had very, very good success with their stuff.
And thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Karen on Facebook says her favorite weird plant is a native perennial called Rattlesnake mm-hmm. Master, mm-hmm. which reminds her of something that belongs in a Dr. Seuss book.
I love that as well. Rattlesnake Master is a prairie plant, and so we can put that in a very, very tough situation, and it will do beautifully. And it does look a little bit like a Sputnik, and it's a lot of fun. When you look at weird plants, I think one of my favorite easy plants is just a big, huge allium. Those we put those into a garden I sit on the board for and out in Little Delavan, and we put those out by the front, and every spring people go by to see the Dr. Seuss little balls that are sticking out, and they're about 8 to 10 inches across, and so you have a bare ground little sticks with these huge balls on the top of them. It's just a blast.
Love it. We have Kathleen in Delavan up next. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Listen, I was, I followed up with P.J. Leash after he was on before. We were talking about Japanese beetles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he actually did some more research. So the name of the Gardens Alive has them, but they're always out because it's a big, long story. But anyhow, Green Earth Agriculture and Turf will have them in March or May, I'm sorry. And you can either spray the beetles, or it's a solution for on the ground, and it's a new strain that will kill the beetles.
So it's a bacterial strain.
He's talking about a BT, probably,
yeah,
right?
BT, yeah. But it's the Galerii strain.
Okay.
It's specific for the Japanese beetles, and people need to get it because it's so good, and it's going to be approved in Wisconsin very shortly, apparently.
Good. Excellent. PJ, he's on top of it.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling, Kathleen. Appreciate it.
Wonderful info. Yep.
Andrea in Spring Green is up next. Hi, Andrea.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have had someone in the last few years to spray for the Japanese beetles, but also for the wasps, because we have a hard time with the wasps on the south side of our house. And the beetles are kind of under control, but I would like to continue to do something about the wasps without hurting good bees. Is there anything that I should consider for that?
If you're going directly after the wasp nest and spraying specifically on that, you may get some collateral damage on good bees, but you may take the wasps out. The timing on spraying wasps is kind of specific if you want to control very well in a few applications, and that's either early evening or early morning or early evening when most of them are back home. Are you trying to do this yourself?
No, we've hired someone to come in and do it.
Okay. Do you know, are they doing the timing on the spraying, or are they coming in and spraying in the middle of the day?
They're coming in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
I would say ask. You're not going to get the best control that way. So I would say ask them if they can alter when they come to do that and come either earlier in the morning or in about dusk time. I know that that's outside of most treatment times, but you're going to get the best bang for your buck that way, and they're going to be more in the nest rather than flying around and distributing the product that was sprayed.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Jim in Cleveland, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello. My question is there something we can do to get what's supposed to be a flowering tree to flower? It was about 7 years ago that we planted what we thought was a flowering plum tree, and it's never blossomed.
Okay. Is it just a flowering plum?
Yes.
And does it have red leaves?
Kind of.
Kind of purpley?
Yes.
Okay. So you should actually get some flowers on that every spring. Can you tell me if you're pruning it and when?
We haven't pruned it.
Okay.
Ever.
Ever. And you have not had flowers on it.
But we do have a lot of deer in the area. Would deer be coming and eating them or nibbling the buds at night?
They could, but I think you would notice that damage. And my suggestion would be to get another one and put that in, because it's not an expensive plant, and you can get that as a shrub, and that's going to be a lot less expensive than buying a big tree. And if you can get another flowering plum shrub and plant that within about 50 to 100 feet of the existing one and see if maybe that might spur it a little bit to flower. There are things that you can do to stress them out. And on that one, I'm not sure if there's a male and a female. I don't think so, but I'm not 100% sure on that. And so I would say get something else that's in the family, even a different plum tree out there of some sort, shrub or tree, and give it a couple of years and see if maybe you get a little bit more activity, if they might be shooting some activity back and forth, and maybe you'll get some flowering on that. Otherwise, you can start to stress it, but I don't like to do that.
I see.
If it's something that you, in my yard, if I wanted to play with it, I might stress it, but most people don't like to do that because that can really be detrimental to your tree.
And
it's probably looking pretty nice right now, too, isn't it?
Well, it gets lots of leaves, mm-hmm. and it looks nice with the foliage, but we bought it as a flowering tree and have never had blossoms.
Is it in the sun?
It's on, let's see, the southwest corner.
Does it get a lot of sun there?
Yes.
Okay. That would be the other thing I would take a look at. Also, over-fertilization can actually reduce flower. So are you fertilizing the lawn or the tree?
Not really.
Okay. No. If it's just kind of normal stuff, I don't worry about that. If somebody is over-fertilizing, you can get more leaf growth, and that will kind of suppress sometimes the flowering. But other than that, I would have to take a look to see if there is something out there. Frost? Have you gotten frost-nipped?
Yes, probably.
Okay. But I can't imagine that you would have gotten frost-nipped 7 years in a row.
No.
You know, I mean, that's the thing. You have never had flowers on it. And I would expect that you would have had flowers by this point, because even nut trees, which take forever to produce nuts, will do something within 7 years or so. So I'm a little surprised that you have had no activity whatsoever. So I would say maybe prune it out. And get some more light in there, and get some structure kind of realigned, and maybe just doing a little bit of that might spur it to do something, and then add another one. Why not?
Okay.
All right. Get that try.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. George on Facebook has been shopping around for fruit trees, and he says the nursery price for an apple tree is about $120, and the box store garden center price is $25. Is it worth paying the big difference for a nursery tree?
Boy, it really depends on what you're talking about. You may actually be talking about apples and oranges in the quality of the apple tree. If you're talking about the exact same species and cultivar, it's very likely that you can get by with a little bit cheaper tree, but knowing which nursery center it comes from also gives you the ability to take it back. And they're going to, I really am a proponent of small nursery centers, local ones. And, you know, really take a look at the size, and you may even ask the people at the box store and the nursery center to pull it out of the pot for you so you can take a look at the roots. And, you know, typically I will do that myself, but I don't advocate that people go around to garden centers and pull things out of pots. So ask somebody there to show you what the root system looks like, and then compare and contrast. Do a measurement on what size the diameter of the trunk is, and then take a look at what the roots look like. And you can kind of see whether there's going to be a difference between those two.
Yeah, that's a very good suggestion. Robert on Facebook posted some nice photos of his yard, and he asked if you could recommend any perennials or berry shrubs for heavy shade.
Ooh, for heavy shade. There's not a lot of berries that like heavy shade. Although you can get some blackberries that will tolerate a bit of shade.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, and not even black raspberries, but blackberries. And with a little bit of non-existent global warming that we have, you actually can get some of the thornless to grow beautifully around the state as well, just with a little bit of protection. So you can try that. Trees that will do well in heavy shade, a pawpaw tree actually does beautifully in shade, in heavy shade, as an understory tree. And that one is really unusual. I don't see much for problems with it. We look at blowflies for pollinating that one. They're great trees. So you might want to give that one a look. So pawpaw.
Yeah.
I actually, honeyberries need a little bit more sun. So you really, that's kind of what you're stuck with. Blueberries you can give a try, but most of us, our pH is so high that you'll put a blueberry shrub in and you may get a year to two out of it, and then it starts looking like something that should have been pruned a long time ago at the ground level. So you might want to give that a whirl, because blueberries will tolerate a lot of shade also. They do better in sun, but they will tolerate a lot of shade.
Turning now to Pam in Kellogg. Hi, Pam.
Good morning. I forgot to ask the second question, part of my question, so I will give you the whole thing. I have some bamboo, and normally when you buy that, they have, you know, kind of in a rocky water thing. Well, mm-hmm. Now they've gotten so big, I want to break some off. And I'm wondering, do they need dark ground or sandy or what? And then the other part was, you know, you buy them and they're spiral. So how would you get these young shoots to spiral?
You have to train them. And often you do that on some sort of a removable form.
Okay.
And or else you can use wire spiral and kind of train it around that. Because as homeowners, we have to adapt to what we can find around. So spiraling wire might help with that. And you train them when they're very young.
Oh.
And then that gets removed. Are you talking about planting them indoors or outdoors?
Well, I'm presuming they'd be able to be set out in the summer, but yes, I have them indoors.
Okay. If you want to do them outside, my son actually has played around with doing water bamboo and putting it into soil. And what he did is he likes to play around with things, and he added the soil slowly.
Okay.
And that way kind of, it was almost a slurry and it was rather disgusting looking, but he just started filling it in more and more. But they really, the roots are different between water and what they need for soil. And so if you're taking cuttings and you start them in a loose, moist soil type mixture, you'll be fine. I think that they'll adapt just beautifully, because bamboo does beautifully in the tropics. It does beautifully in a lot of different conditions, things that are hardy outside. You'd be amazed at what they will grow in. So it's really just how they develop those roots as to what you want to put them in. So if you're taking cuttings, pop them right into a moist soil and get them started in that, and you should be able to move that in and out rather easily.
Well, they need to be fertilized then.
Sure. Everything needs fertilizer.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you for calling. And let's turn to Christina in Glenwood City. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I live in western Wisconsin. I'm near the Twin Cities, and my zone is typically 3, some microclimate, zone 5. And you mentioned nut trees. Are there any nut trees that would be hardy for my area?
Sure. If you want nothing else to grow, you can always stick a walnut in, because we have plenty of walnuts that will grow. Hickory nuts will do well also. Hazelnuts do fantastically for us. And the European hazelnuts they're okay. We tend to get a little bit of a shorter life out of those than the species that are native to North America, but they can be grown as shrubs if you want trees. The Turkish hazelnuts, I think we may be pushing your zone with that, but I would give it a whirl, because the Turkish hazelnut trees are beautiful and tough as nails. I popped one in. I still have yet to see nuts on it, because it's only been in for about 8 years. They are notorious for having a long period before they develop nuts, but it has a beautiful conical shape on the canopy. Natural, you don't have to do anything to it, and the bark is wonderful. It's kind of corky, and you can kind of push your finger into it. It's really, really fun.
Sure.
All the way around.
Yes. And may I ask one other question?
Sure.
Great. I have a very, very, very long driveway, and it is gravel. Well, grass will grow on there,
mm-hmm.
and so you have to use Roundup, and I feel so guilty about that, because I'm concerned about the bees and just the environment in general. Is there something more that I can be doing?
Sure. How about a very satisfying blowtorch? And I mean that seriously, because you can get the weed torches that you can hook up to a small propane tank, and you can blast those things with fire. I just warn people, do not do this around large grass areas that are dry, around buildings, around anything with dry brush. But on a gravel drive or a cement area, hitting it with heat will do wonders, absolute wonders. And you may have to hit it a couple of times, but you're not going to be using any chemicals to control.
Wow, what a fantastic idea. Can you tell me when I should start doing that?
Whenever the grass comes up.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, really when grass is small, it's when it's really starting to put all of its energy into growing. You've got succulent little blades and the crown is still slightly exposed. I would hit it at that time and continue to hit it, because if you wait until you get those huge tufts of grass, you have to kill everything above before you start getting to the crown to really do some damage. So hit it while it's young.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. I want to go back to bamboo for a minute, because someone called about, you know, it can be a real invasive.
Horrible.
So you don't want to be just planting it out in the...
There are some that really will not survive outside here. The tropical ones will not survive. But we have many types of bamboo that are very, very tough. And you get that and you can't get rid of it. And it spreads by runners all over the place. And you do not want to go there. There are some bamboos that are clumping and they don't send the runners out that do as much damage. And you will find that in quality, either on online catalogs or whatever. If you're looking at different types of bamboo, you look for a clumping, smaller-sized bamboo that's more grass-like. Typically, we don't have a huge problem with those, but do be aware that they are an issue. One lovely garden I visited in Georgia, she planted them inside concrete. It was almost like what they use for silos. So it was a concrete foundation with a solid bottom, and she still had concrete escape. So it's really something, you know, it's like mint. You don't put it in unless you're serious about it, about control. So definitely, I'm glad they mentioned that. That's a good reminder.
And Jim and Hudson, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Thanks. I don't really like to use chemicals to control wasps and hornets. I sort of MacGyver my shop vac.
Awesome.
And so I'll set up a stepladder underneath the eaves where especially a paper wasp has built one of those big nests, and I'll use any kind of tubing I can find, whether it's paper tubes, to make a longer wand or extension. And then I just set it up about an inch away from the opening and, you know, duct tape everything together and turn on my shop vac. And it doesn't matter if you do it during the day or in the evening. There's any bees coming or wanting to leave the nest go into the shop vac. And after a couple hours of that, you can just vacuum the whole nest up.
Wonderful idea. Wonderful.
It works well.
I love it. I absolutely love it.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate the call. Oh, man. Liz Freemuth, our guest today. She provides concierge horticultural services for her business, The Garden Hoe. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Liz Freemuth. Great to have her along. And certainly, if you have a question for her, maybe you've got an experience to share, I'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo, garden photo, we'd love to see it up on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. You can also post a question there as well. And Liz, James sent us a photo of his mustard greens and Swiss chard.
It doesn't that look fantastic?
Oh, man, that looks ready to eat.
Yeah, lunch is coming up. I'd like that for a salad. That looks wonderful.
Thanks for sending that, James. Cal in Sugar Camp has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Cal.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I remember about 4 or 5 years ago, I was wandering through one of these greenhouses, and
came across a white echinacea that smelled like honey.
Mm.
And ever since, every white echinacea I have found for sale does not smell at all. And I was wondering if that's a particular variety. I thought it was white swan, but white swan doesn't smell either.
Have you sniffed a magnum? It's either magnum or magna, one of those.
Okay.
That one may be slightly scented. Was it a double or?
Just a single?
Yeah. And if it was about a few years ago, that was one that was out and may smell slightly honeyish. The nice thing is that's one of those plants that they're going back to breeding scent back in, because originally it was a scented plant, but I can't remember the last time I smelled an echinacea that had a good scent to it that was a cultivar. And really some of the old ones that you have out in the prairie, those you can still catch a little bit of a whiff. But I would look at magnum.
All right.
Well, thank you.
You bet.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have, we have a question from Lori on Facebook wondering if she can still transplant rhubarb.
Yeah. Rhubarb is one of those things that I think you can do almost any time, and if it's a big enough root, it'll be fine. People will disagree with me. They say, yes, there's a specific time when you do it. I've not had that issue. As long as you move a big hunk of it and just make sure it's got water and nutrients, it will be fine.
And Gail from Baraboo put a new sidewalk in, and the ground around her clematis, Jack Manny, I think, has sunk. The ground has a tendency to dry out. Can she dig it up and level it out without hurting the clematis?
You're going to set it back if you dig it out and lift it up. If that's acceptable to you, then I would say go ahead and do that. It really depends on how much it's sunk, because you never want it to be too deep into the ground. So you may be stuck with, yes, I don't think you're going to kill it, but you may set it back slightly. If you get a couple of people out there to help you, you might be able, and use a couple of garden forks, and have two people put those garden forks in on either side, get down really deep, get a nice mass, try and get a feel for where that root mass is, and get those forks down in there and have them lift up, and you can actually kind of shoot soil or compost down in there and fill it up so that you're not ripping the whole thing out of the ground. You'll still get some setback, but that may actually lessen the amount of setback. So you're really just going to very gently shovel soil into those empty spaces as they lift up to the level that you want it at, and then water it in good. And clematis like a cool root zone, so putting more compost over the top of that so that it gets nice and cool will be fantastic, and hopefully you won't see too much setback, and that way you don't have to rip the whole thing out of the ground.
Katie sent us a photo on Facebook and wondering if there's any idea why her lilac is budding on one side but dead looking on the other side. She's got a photo of it.
Yeah, my answer to that is it's half dead. really, you kind of figured that one out on your own, I think, Katie. It's very possible. I would look towards the base. We can't really tell from the photo, but I would look toward the base. Yeah, you've got a split down there. Dig around the base of that plant and see if it might be in the ground just a pinch too deep. And if it looks like the stems are going way underground, you may want to, because it looks like a relatively young plant.
Yeah.
You may want to raise that up out of the ground slightly so that you don't have the stems buried underground. Now, most lilacs will sucker out a little bit, but that doesn't mean that you want those above ground stems underground. And so I would, first off, I think you're going to have to cut off that part that is dead. But I would dig around and see what it looks like and how deep. If it is a little bit too deep, raise it up, and I would continue to just treat it nicely. What I would suggest that you look for, though, is when you cut that part of that lilac off, look at the interior tissue. And if you're seeing something that doesn't look quite right, if it's brown and it's not where you're seeing rings of brown in it in the cross cut, I would say it would be a good idea to send that up to Brian for a sample diagnosis. Brian at Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison and check, because they can actually suffer from verticillium wilt. And if you've got a plant with vert, it really is more kind of like a plant leukemia, where it may suffer complete and total death, or it may just kind of limp along for a little while. If you do have one like that, you may want to replace it and maybe get something else that is not going to be susceptible to that. You may have it on, you will have it on your site if that is what's there, or may have come in on the plant too. But I would say, yeah, it's half dead. And just follow those instructions and you should actually get an answer and be able to get it going. Should survive fine and come back if it doesn't have vert.
Al in Onalaska, we turn to you next. Hi, Al.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, listen, I've been trying to grow some white ginger plants for a few years now.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been doing fine as far as growing, but I can never get them to flower.
And are you talking about the tropical plant white ginger? It's not really a ginger, but it's called white ginger.
The flower plant.
Yeah. Boy, what to do? How long have you had it?
Oh, probably about 10, 12 years.
Have you divided it?
Several times. I actually have 3 plants.
Okay, so it's not the fact that it's old and tired. Okay. I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue.
I keep splitting them up, which is why I have 3 plants.
Yeah.
And they grow hardy, but...
Are you giving them enough light?
During the spring through fall, we keep them outside. We don't bring them in.
Okay. Well, on some of the tropical plants, and white ginger I'm not 100% on, because I know I grow blue ginger, and blue ginger does not like full sun. It does not like it. And I actually use mine as house plants, and when they don't even go outside in the summer. I just keep them in the house. And I can take cuttings off of them, but they're just in a very, it's a diffused light situation. If I have them in full sun, they do not like it. So you may have to take a look at the light requirements for that one specifically. And without knowing the scientific name, I'm guessing that it's going to be related to the blue ginger that I'm working with. And so you may have to kind of scale back on the light a little bit. They do like fertilizer, but they don't like fertilizer until spring.
Okay.
And so you may want to watch that. And then water needs, that typically are a little bit higher on water needs than what we would expect. So
yeah.
If you're not seeing any browning on the leaves, then you've got that down pat, but then maybe adjust the light a bit.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for calling. Charna in Viola will turn to you now. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Great.
What can we do for you?
Well, actually, I heard your speaker say that they use a blowtorch for killing weeds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have been for about 10 years. I just take vinegar and pour it on the weeds, and they just die, and then I pull out the dead weeds.
Yeah, vinegar does work, but vinegar is one that you have to be careful with. And hopefully, you must know what you're doing because you're killing your weeds beautifully and you have it. Nothing else has died, so that's a good thing. I do caution people that you do want to be a little bit careful because vinegar is an acid, and some plants don't react. Some plants that are surrounding you don't react as well. But yes, vinegar has been proven to work also.
All right. There we go. Thank you, Charna. Appreciate the call.
Yep.
And Steve in Menominee, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks. Just sitting here relaxing on this beautiful day. I have a relatively new garden. We've gardened in it last season. And I have potato scab. And I'm wondering if there's, first of all, an organic way of dealing with it, and if not, an inorganic way of dealing with it.
Boy, that one's going to go beyond me. I would actually say that's a question for Brian Huddleston at the Plant Disease Clinic. I'm going to say I have not heard anything organic to use for control of potato scab. And about the best cultural way to deal with that is to get rid of all the potatoes that you have that have scab and start with fresh. Because I do not know of any other way of dealing with that without treatment. And I would defer to him because I'm out of my realm when it comes to apple scab, and that's Brian's territory. So I would suggest you give him send him an email at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. And he actually, if I remember right, has a fact sheet on potato scab on his website. So you might want to give that one a look, too.
Yeah, good idea.
Well,
yep.
Thank you for the information.
Oh, you betcha. Good luck with that.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Happy potatoing. I love potatoes.
I do, too. Janet and Hilbert, have you got a quick question for us?
I actually have some chocolate cherry tomato seeds that I saved from a tomato last year.
Mm-hmm.
And started the plants in the house, and I'm looking for some advice to make sure that I'm going to have some healthy plants this year and get some tomatoes.
Okay. And were the chocolate tomatoes, were they heirlooms or were they hybrids?
I'm not sure. I got the plant from a relative, and we had a rogue plant come up this past year.
Okay. Okay, you may not get, if it was a hybrid and you saved it from seed, you probably are not going to get anything close to what you had. But I say go for it and see what happens, right?
Okay.
Why not? You have these things, they're going. Why not? With tomato plants, one of the biggest things we get is damping off, and you have to make sure that they get plenty of airflow. So having a fan on those and plenty of light down close. Have you started them already?
Yeah, they're about 2 inches high already.
Yeah. Okay, do you have the fan going on them?
I do not. They are just in the windowsill.
Okay, get a fan going on them because that will dry off any of that moisture that's hanging around the stem, and then it will strengthen the stems.
Liz Freemuth, our guest today on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden today here on the Ideas Network on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you along today, and we're visiting with Liz Freemuth. She provides concierge horticultural services through her business, The Garden Hole. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post your question or comment on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and if you've got a nice garden photo, love to see that as well. And Liz, we have Irene in Sun Prairie who's been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Hi.
Oh, that sounds good.
Irene, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of comments. When you're using vinegar in the garden, it works beautifully, but use eye protection because if you get it in your eye, it's instant blindness, irreversible.
That is a good suggestion. Anytime you're using anything that could potentially hurt you, you should be using appropriate protection. Thank you for the reminder. That's excellent.
The other one is your potato scab. That organism is sensitive to acid. So if you put a teaspoon of soil sulfur in the hole when you plant the potatoes, that will cut down on it considerably.
Well, that's an excellent suggestion.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Diana emailed to ask if there's anything she can plant that might make her garden unattractive to cats.
Huh.
Stray cats in the area have been using her garden as a litter box.
If you figure that one out, give me a call because my neighbor's cats go in my yard too. I'm sure that there is something out there, but that's kind of a question for the vet more than it is for me because I don't know of any plants specifically that keep cats out.
There aren't any that keep them out. There are, I think there may be kinds of materials that you might be able to put down, sharp gravel and such but that can look unattractive too.
It can, and that presents a whole new maintenance problem. That's an excellent suggestion, though, sharp gravel. But as far as plants, no. I know they like catnip, so you might want to plant that over towards your neighbor's yard. Maybe you can keep them that way instead of bringing them in. So rather than looking at it as how do we keep, what do we plant to keep them out, plant something to keep them away and just plant it over next to the neighbor.
And Kel called to ask if you could recommend a good chocolate-scented geranium.
Boy, I don't know of any cultivars out there that, named cultivars that come to mind. I only see them listed as chocolate scented geraniums. So I don't. I wish I had a suggestion for you, but I would say do as I do. And that's when you're going through the garden center, go sniffing. You do a nice rub on the leaves and sniff away. But as far as a cultivar, no, I'm sorry. I don't have a cultivar suggestion.
Let's go to Paul in Kenosha. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Larry. Larry, I would appreciate it if you would give very specific instructions on your method of trapping moles and voles. I guess it's also voles. With bacon, a mouse trap, and a 5-gallon bucket. How far do you go down? And do you cook the bacon?
You know, if you kind of partially cook the bacon, then you're going to get a little more smell. And what you do, if you can see the trail that the mole is using, you take your make a little hole in that trail, and then you get your bacon and you put it on a mouse trap, and you put it over the hole that you've made, and then you put the pail over that. And that keeps other animals away from it. And the mole comes along and smells or sees, gets the opening. And I know one guy trapped 14.
Wow.
Over the course of a summer that way.
Wow.
So that's really all you need to do. You can give it a try and see. Now, I have not used it myself. Mm-hmm. But I've had more than one person tell me, oh, I'm glad you gave me that advice, and I didn't give it, and somebody else did, mm-hmm. and because it worked.
If it works, right? Go for it. If it works, go for it.
There you go, Paul. Thanks for calling. Don and Shano, your turn. Hi, Don.
Yeah, hi, Larry. The question is, how do you get rid of Japanese knotweed?
Ooh, oh, that's a terrible.
That's a tough one, boy. How big of a problem is this?
It's big. It's growing by 2-3 feet a year.
Oh man,
spreading, and it's just it's out of control. There's no doubt.
Yeah,
the one suggestion I would have would the DNR website mm-hmm. has a section on invasive plants, and I know Japanese knotweed is one of them, and they have recommendations there on that site in one of their little publications, and it's free. If you go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, look under invasive plants, and you will find some recommendations. I, frankly, it's tough. You have to just keep after it.
Yeah. I know brush killer, it only works minimally on that stuff, and you have to keep at it and at it and at it and at it. It's horrible.
Yeah, once it's there, you really have a lot of work to get rid of it.
And even, whatever their recommendation is for product, you have to almost have a 2 or 3-man crew that goes out to do it, because if you're cutting and painting, you need to paint immediately after it's cut, and that can be very difficult to actually do that one person. You have to put your tool down, pick it up, et cetera. So it really is a multi-person task to go through and just cut and treat and then try and get the roots treated as well. It'll take a very long time, and I wish you well.
Yeah, but go to that site. Yeah. Go to that DNR site, and you'll get some information. Alicia in Greenwood, your turn. Hi, Alicia.
Hi. My son and I transplanted lilac. It was like there was a mean bush, and then there was little babies that came out or mm-hmm. babies that grew next to it, mm-hmm. and it hasn't bloomed. It's planted underneath a pine tree, but it has full sun.
Okay, how long has it been?
Oh, 10 years at least.
Oh goodness, goodness. Move it. It's not getting what it needs. And so move it out of there. And unless it, does this have meaning for you? Is it a special shrub that you pulled from somewhere else?
I asked him, I said, can I just cut it down? He goes, I don't care. Because I thought maybe it meant something to him, but it doesn't.
just to, to be curious, I would move it out of there. If it's underneath a pine tree, I mean, lilacs will tolerate a whole lot of junk before not blooming. So the things that I look at is that something else is out competing for nutrients. If the shrub itself is growing well and you're still not getting lilacs on it, there's something wrong with the light that's getting to it, or the competition from the roots, from the pine tree roots. So I would say dig it up and move it, or just cut it off and say, fine, that didn't work. It might be that stressing that out a little bit, you'll get blooms on it. But then the other question I have to ask you is, do you prune it?
I haven't.
Okay. So this is an unpruned lilac for 10 years.
Yep, and it has never bloomed, yes.
Okay, and how big is it now after 10 years? Has it grown?
It grows not terribly rapidly, but okay. It's intruding on the driveway. It's about 5-6 feet tall and maybe 6 feet across.
Yeah, if it doesn't mean anything to you, I would just cut it off.
I'd whack it off.
Yeah, just whack it off and be done with it. But you know, as curiosity, if it's that close to the driveway, you know, you and a pine tree, it could be that it's just being out compete by the other things there and not doing well. So yeah, cut it off. Do you like that for an easy answer?
You have our permission.
That's an easy answer, but maybe I'll convince him that it's an heirloom to him, and maybe he's.
I say that would be good just for sheer amusement factor, because that's going to be a bear to move. Because something that's 6 feet across is going to have a pretty good root system on it. But, you know, if you do decide you want to do that, when you go down in there and start digging it out, don't be afraid to whack at those roots, because lilacs are really quite tough, and it doesn't take a whole lot to actually get it to grow. So even if you take off part of it and move it to a different spot where it's going to get some sun and some air and not be really in competition with other plants around there, you might want to give that a try just to see what the blooms are going to look like. I think you deserve it after 10 years.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alicia.
Oh, man. Scott in Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good afternoon.
How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you. I was wondering, I have a silver maple in my backyard, and we've been there for like almost 11 years now, and it's growing beautiful shape. It's nice and round, but we have overhead power lines coming from the pole in the backyard to the house, and they're going to start to be an issue, and I don't really want to deal with it. So I was thinking about taking that out, but I would like to replace it with something, and I was thinking maybe like an apple tree or two, but I was wondering if you would recommend one that doesn't get out too far, that I wouldn't have to worry about, you know, pruning back. You know, I got about 20 feet or so, you know, from the center of the tree, about 20 feet or so, and I wasn't sure if and I'm in Eau Claire, so I don't know if that makes a difference.
It does, yeah. I would say look for a dwarf selection. You can get rootstock that's going to be short. And so what you're looking for is a dwarf tree. And up in Eau Claire, I really would think that they're going to have a number of very good apple trees at your local garden center, and I would go and find one from them. Once, if you're going to take on an apple tree and you're going to start pruning it and shaping it, you can actually keep it to just about any size you want, as long as it's not a full-growing apple tree that's going to get to be about 30 feet, you know, 40 feet tall. So if you look around and see what you like for an apple, you're going to want to look for something that is very disease-resistant, that has got, you know, depending on when you want it to be ready, either an early or a later fruit, it's going to be tons to choose from. Fresh, do you want fresh eating? Do you want pie apples? So I can't tell you what to choose. So if you kind of narrow it down from there and go to your local garden center and have them talk to you about what they've got for dwarfs, I think you'll be much happier that way.
And you want something that is resistant to, like, apple scab.
Scab, definitely.
For sure.
Yeah. And
you have to usually plant them in pairs? Because I'm not sure if anybody else in the neighborhood. I mean, I have another, I have another fruit-bearing tree in the backyard. And I can't think of the name. Excuse me. It's got, like, little, they look like little blackberries.
Okay.
I mean, if another fruit tree is in the area, or do you have to put apple trees in pairs?
Crab apple would be good if you don't want another fruit-bearing tree, because crabapples will pollinate apple trees. So generally, yes, having another one within about 100 feet is highly recommended if you actually want fruit. And excuse me, so you could do that, or you could do another fruit bearing and just do a different type of different cultivar of apple.
Yeah, you could, yeah. And use another dwarf.
Exactly. And really training them, take a look at the publications that Extension puts out on training apple trees, because you can do an awful lot. You just need to start early. And, you know, you could train it to be open and kind of flattish and out, going outward and down, or you can actually train it to be in slightly pyramid form so that you can accommodate whatever those lines are going to provide, you know, provide restraint constraints for you, and that'll help out.
If you go to UW Extension Learning Store, learningstore.uwex.edu, I think is the is the sign. You can, they're free. You can.
Exactly. And the apples are fantastic. If you don't want to go on a regular spray schedule, you know, a kind of conventional chemical schedule, pick something that is extremely disease resistant. And I've had very good luck with a product called Surround, S-U-R-R-O-U-N-D. That's a kaolin clay, completely organic. You just have to keep the tree covered throughout the season, and it provides a barrier for insects and diseases. And it won't do any remediation on issues, but it will provide a barrier, and it does a pretty darn good job as long as you keep them covered. But you need to go with disease resistant to start with.
All right.
Does that help you out? Does that help you out?
Oh, tremendously. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Excellent. Thanks a lot for calling. And Don in Ladysmith is up next. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Good afternoon. We need some help.
All right.
We have two rhododendron bushes, actually. They're about 5 to 6 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
In the spring, they flower, but only right at the ground level.
Mm. You're getting frost dieback. They're nipping the buds.
That's what we were concerned about.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, rhododendrons, is this a big leaf rhododendron?
I don't believe so.
Smaller leaves, so more of an azalea?
Smaller leaves.
Okay,
yeah,
so smaller. More azalea.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you know which one it is? Do you know the name of it?
No, I don't. We just moved into the house a couple of years ago, so
okay. And
I'm not too familiar with what was there.
If you can actually provide some cover for it over winter, if you want to do that, I would suggest maybe a barrier that would be burlap, but you keep it away from the shrub. You don't want it touching the shrub, so you don't wrap the shrub. You create kind of a little fence around it, and that may help with the wind damage, but you still, if you've got it dying back and only the buds dying back and only blooming down where the snow cover was, then you really may not have something that's going to be cold hardy enough. And what I would suggest looking at are Northern Lights series of azaleas and rhododendrons.
I'm familiar with those. Yeah.
Okay. I would go and look at those beautiful colors on them. Bred in Minnesota, and I think you'd have a better chance of flower and survival with that.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Good luck.
My chickadees love it, so we kind of hate to take them out. But
you know, if you want to play with them, then I would suggest putting up a barrier and just covering that with burlap, and maybe even tossing some leaves into that after hard freeze. You don't want to do it before the ground is frozen, but then just cover them that way. And when spring starts to come, then you take them off, you know, February or so, if the temperatures are warm enough to kind of avoid dieback, then maybe that will give you a couple extra years while you decide what to do about them.
Okay. We'll try it.
All Excellent.
Right. Thanks, Don. Thanks a lot for calling. And Lyle in La Crosse. Hi, Lyle.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Good. I've been waiting all winter for the conversations to move more towards flowers.
We are a patient lot up north, aren't we?
Absolutely. I have got some gladiolas that I dug up last fall, and maybe I stored them a little too damp. I don't know, because this spring they decided that they wanted to start growing before I can put them into the ground. And some of them are, you know, 8 to 10 inches long already, and of course they're brilliant white, but I don't think they're supposed to be that way. So I don't know when I can plant them, or what I can do about that.
Yeah, it's a little too early to put those out because...
That's what I thought.
Yeah, it's a little too early. I actually, what you might do, boy, because that's a little bit long. Had you caught them a little bit earlier, I would say just toss them more into, are they in any light at all, or are they growing in the dark?
No, they're growing in the dark. I actually have them in an old cat litter bucket with the lid closed but holes in it, and then pine shavings in with them. And
stinkers.
With other bulbs.
Okay. And the other thing, you know, otherwise what I would tell you is if they're telling you they want to grow, you can maybe get a jump on the season by potting them up.
Okay.
And then transplanting them. They aren't particularly fond of being transplanted, so you might actually use peat pots and get them started and just kind of move them out, and then you can toss them out in the garden when it gets warm enough.
All right. Now, that one or two of them are extra long like that, maybe 8 inches. When I pot them, should I bury them extra deep so that they're underground, or should I leave that length stay above the ground?
You know what? I would just leave it above the ground. You may have to transition that a little bit more slowly into light, though, so it doesn't burn off. Yeah. Because if you try and bury that, I think you may kill it off.
Okay. That's
yeah.
What I was kind of thinking too. And I hate to ask another question, but I've been waiting all winter to ask. I have chickens. Is there any kind of natural fertilizer that I can use on my gardens? Last year I decided not to fertilize because, like I said, I have free-roaming chickens. And I just didn't have the success that I wanted to have. Is there anything I can use that won't bother the birds?
I would actually suggest using a rich compost, like a mushroom compost or something like that, because the birds can dig around in that to their heart's content.
Okay, and I made a compost out of the compost that I get from the chickens that
go
I put
for
that on last fall, but I don't know if that's...
Go for it, yeah, for it. Yeah, if you've got it on hand, I would use that. Chicken may burn if it's really, really fresh, but if you've had that outside since last winter, I think it should be fine.
Yeah, it composted for over a year. So.
Yeah, I think that'll be good.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
You bet.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Long time ago, I had a garden in an area that was once a chicken coop and all the chickens around it. And, man, I'm telling you, that first year.
Nothing better, right? Nothing better.
I tell you, there was no problem getting some fast-growing plants there.
Yeah.
I think Paul might have or Pat might have a quick question. Pat?
Yeah, hi, thanks. Real quick, I bought some privet hedges from Jung's and bare-rooted, and I'm looking forward to get those in this weekend, but I have a peony that's kind of in the way, and I'm just wondering your advice. Is this not a great time to try and move that peony, or what's your suggestion?
Not a great time, but the option is you can't plant your privet hedge. So in gardening, we do what we need to do. Just, you may see a reduction in flower because the best time to move them is August 17th and beyond. That's like the cutoff day for peony people. But if you take enough of a root mass and dirt and just try and get as much as possible, move it intact and don't divide it, you should be fine to get some flower.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling in. Liz, thank you. Oh, what a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Always fun. You have got the best listeners ever. We Wisconsin people are awesome.
Liz Freemuth, who is the owner of The Garden Hole. That's her business, Concierge Horticultural Services. Always great to have her with us. And thank you for listening, and I hope you'll stay with us because there's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.